funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much money do you have set aside for a rainy day? And how might we change the world if we spent more of our savings? Many individual Americans have responded to the rocky economic conditions of the past several years by increasing the rate at which we save our disposable income, rather than spending it on the goods and services we can enjoy but can live without. As voters, many of us have supported policy that offers breaks to the so-called job creators in the hopes that lower corporate taxes will spur hiring and expansion. But is any of that actually working to regain the ground our economy has lost? James Livingston is professor of history at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and he's here to explain why he is skeptical. His new book is called Against Thrift: Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. Jim, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You write that the Great Depression and the current economic downturn are, in fact, similar events, both caused by too much saving, not enough spending. Tell us more about that.
Well, let's see. In the 1920s, what happened was pretty much what happened here between, say, 1973 or 4 and the turn of the new century. And that is an enormous transfer of income from labor to capital, away from wages towards profits. And that redistribution of income was accomplished through the tax code. It wasn't anybody's hidden agenda. It was designed in the 20s, and it was designed in more recent times to promote job creation, to promote growth, by handing over more money to what you just called the so-called job creators, that is to say the people who invest in new plant and equipment, hire new labor, and contribute in that way to growth. It didn't work in the 20s. It brought us the Great Depression. And it hasn't worked since the mid-1970s, or more specifically, after the Reagan tax cuts.
So what happens is that money is invested in speculative investments rather than reinvested back into the companies that, in question?
Right, and that's the most puzzling or intriguing aspect of the argument, it seems to me. And we've got figures for this for the 20s. They're pretty astonishing. Between 1926 and 1929, for example, industrial corporations, now industrial corporations, mind you, opened savings accounts at banks, and these were timed deposits. That is to say, there was a penalty for withdrawing the money too early. They also started loaning directly on call in the stock market. These are on their own account, industrial corporations. Now, why weren't they reinvesting that money in creating jobs? It's very simple. They didn't have to. All they had to do was, instead of taking those profits and investing in new plant and equipment, all they had to do was replace and maintain the existing capital stock, and it became more productive. And it shed labor as well, of course, but it became more productive. Now, the same thing, exactly the same process, has happened since, let's call it, 1983. Exactly the same thing. Huge transfers of income to capital, in the hope, of course, that it will be invested, create jobs, and create growth. But what happened was just like what happened in the 1920s, a bubble. There was no place else to put the money except into speculative markets.
So this is not so different from when we talk about individual tax rates, saying that giving a tax break to, say, the middle class, that money gets spent because the middle class is living on smaller margins than, say, the very wealthy, who will just sock that money away truly save it for a rainy day.
Right. Yes, I think so. In fact, it seems to me one of the ways we could solve this problem of surplus capital, that is to say too much money in the hands of too few investors who, again, don't know what to do with it, one of the ways to solve that problem is to improve or revise the tax code and treat corporations the way they want to be treated as persons. Use the personal income tax to transfer income away from corporations towards individuals, towards that middle class you just mentioned.
So how do we know, Jim, that corporations won't, as a lot of people have predicted, turn around and cut jobs if they have to pay higher taxes or refuse to hire anyone else?
That is a really great question. One way to put it would be to say, if we raise the marginal tax rate on corporate income, they'll take what income remains to them, and they'll take it overseas where they're taxed lower, where growth rates are higher, where risk is higher too, but where growth is higher. What we have to do, and you've read the book, so one of my arguments in part two is that beyond regulation of the corporations or re-regulation of the financial sector, we have to socialize investment. That is to say, when the corporations say, well, we're just not going to put up with this, we're going to go overseas, or we're just going to hoard the money, our response should be, you're already hoarding the money.
Hmm.
I think we're sitting on $2 trillion worth of profits that they're not investing. We all know that. It's about 8% of GDP now. I think what we have to do is face up honestly to the question of what kind of jobs do we want, what rate of growth do we want, and it seems to me this crisis is an opportunity in that sense. We have to ask ourselves what contributes to growth, what kind of growth do we want,
and the way we do that is by voting with our dollars, by spending them.
Well, that's the beginning. But when I say socialization of investment, I mean we're going to have political discussions of what kind of growth, again, and what kind of jobs we want to create. We cannot leave it in private hands anymore. Now, I know that sounds a little bit scary, quite possibly even radical, but we have, in fact, socialized investment in all kinds of ways. The front page story 2 days ago in the New York Times about how training costs are borne by states in the South, and then these workers who have been trained by using public dollars become employees in Caterpillar plants or in automobile plants. This is in Georgia and in South Carolina as well. So in that sense, we've already socialized investment, right, in the industrial sector. But look at the financial sector. The taxpayers, guarantee each other's deposits through this thing called the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. We've already socialized bank capital in that sense. So we, the citizens, us 99% who deposit our money in banks, and insure ourselves, we should have a say in how that kind of capital is allocated.
The rate of private investment is not historically linked to GDP growth. Why does that sound untrue when we hear it?
Well, I guess for a couple of reasons. I think the principal reason, and I try to get at this in the book, I'm pretty sure from reading the reviews that I didn't succeed. I think it's because from left to right, from Keynesian to monetarist and to the Hayekians and the Von Mises types, we all believe that investment drives growth. We just believe it, regardless of the evidence. We look at the growth and we say, investment must have done that. That's one reason. So, in other words, it's so theoretically embedded in our thinking about growth that it's a piece of common sense that cannot be challenged. It literally cannot be challenged. If I say this, for example, to people, they say, well, that's impossible. That's just not possible. In fact, it is. I mean, and the data in the book show that. Show that it is possible. The second reason that it sounds outlandish is that gross investment rates have remained pretty consistent over the last 100 years. Somewhere between 14 and 18 or 20% of GDP. So that seems consistent. What is remarkable is the utter atrophy of net investment over the same 100-year period, to the point where it's a vanishing item in the national income and product accounts. And this, that is not new to me, by the way. It's not a new argument on mine to have. Or that I made. It's an argument that has been in the economic literature since at least the late 1920s, but it became a sort of common sense fact amongst economists in the 1950s. People like Harold Badder, Robert Solow, Moses Abramowitz, and many, many others proved to everybody's satisfaction that capital formation or net private investment had very little to do with growth.
What is the impact of government austerity, which is such a big deal, not only in this country, but certainly in Europe right now, on the overall economy, on any domestic economy?
I think especially in a moment of crisis, government austerity is simply devastating because the national income and product accounts, when they talk about investment, they're including government spending and residential investment. All right. So if you cut government spending, you're cutting a crucial source of investment demand. So that's one reason not to do it, particularly in times of crisis when unemployment goes up fast. Another reason is that it is a constant and sometimes growing component of the national income, of gross domestic product. And so to cut government spending is to It's economic suicide, econocide, you might want to say. It's crazy. Now, look at it another way. The growth of employment in the post-World War II period was driven not exclusively, but largely. The fastest sectors of employment growth were in state and private government. In other words, public spending drove that extraordinary post-World War II boom. Once government spending starts to contract, so too will the economy. I think that's one of the reasons that Dick Cheney said that deficits don't matter.
So essentially, we worry. I suppose some of our concerns are more political than fiscal. It's one thing to say, okay, the money is good for the economy, but if you don't think the government should have more money with which to operate, then it's going to be untenable to you.
It's going to be untenable, you say?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, think about it. If we're increasing, if we're allowing the decrease of government spending now, and we're talking state, local, and federal, what we're doing is contributing effectively to higher unemployment rates and slower growth. I don't think there's any way around that. And I think the crisis that we're in will deepen in 2012 in large part because state and local spending can't go anywhere except down.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about spending on an individual basis. You argue that we, even as individuals in this country, need to save less and spend more. First of all, talk about why this strikes us, especially these days, as just shy of immoral.
Or just plainly immoral. it does. In part because it sounds slightly demented under the circumstances we find ourselves. That is, when people like me lost 30% of their of the value of their pension fund between 2008 and 2009, shouldn't we be saving more? At an individual level, it seems to me saving is perfectly reasonable. Although I must say, most individual saving it takes the form of residential investment. That is to say, an investment in a home. Mm-hmm. I have nothing against saving for your kid's college education. What I do have, though, the argument I'm trying to make is this. We can't treat this as every individual's problem. We need to treat this as a social question. If we're going to socialize investment, we're going to have to also socialize, it seems to me, the safety net so that people don't have to save this extraordinary portion of their income so that they're not penurious in poverty when they would like to retire. In other words, let's beef up Social Security. Let's increase, for example, payments in, and let's increase payments out. Let's reduce, I think we can, the age at which people are allowed to retire. So, in effect, yeah, I'm saying what we need to do is socialize saving. We've already socialized saving because we're insuring each other's deposits in the banks. Let's take that a step further.
But go ahead. By beefing all that up, are we robbing Peter to pay Paul if we say retire early, take more benefits? I mean, at some point, some group of current workers has to foot the bill for that. So they don't have money to spend in the short term.
Yeah, except if we can increase the federal revenues, and I think we can pretty easily do that. And if we take up my suggestion on taxing corporate profits, if we can do that, I don't think we're robbing Peter to pay Paul. We're taking money out of the hands of people who are either sitting on it or speculating with it, and we're investing it in our futures. So I don't think it's a zero-sum game. The other way to respond, I think, would be to say we live in an economy of abundance. We can afford to do this. There's no question in my mind that we can afford it.
Let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break. My guest is James Livingston. He's professor of history at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. His new book is called Against Thrift: Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. You can join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is professor of history at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, James Livingston. His new book is called Against Thrift: Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. Join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Jim, what do you say to the argument that by reducing corporate or even small business profits, either by changing tax rates or by wage controls or things like that, that we absolutely will kill any incentive to innovate or to build a business in the first place?
Well, I think the argument is flawed in view of the historical evidence. Again, in theory, yeah, if we reward investors, whether they're large corporations or small businessmen, they will create jobs by spending on plant and equipment. Historically, that's not how it's turned out. It didn't turn out that way between, say, 1923, when the boom really took hold, and 1939, when the Great Depression was still going on. It hasn't worked that way, it seems to me. Between the mid-1980s and our own time, the rate of job creation, even though growth rates sped up during the Reagan years, the rate of job creation declined from the 1970s, which doesn't seem impossible. The rate of job creation declined again in the 90s, and of course, under George W. Bush, it declined once more. So historically speaking, it hasn't happened that way. The innovation that you're talking about comes largely from technological sources. Building things much, much cheaper that are much, much more productive. I'll give you one example. Between 1915 and 1925, as kerosene was displaced by gasoline as the most coveted and sold product from crude petroleum, a lot of patents came online, so that by the mid-1920s, continuous thermal cracking of crude oil was the norm. Those new plants, though, that had been built by the refiners, cost them about a third of what the older plants would have cost them and increased the output of their refineries by 3 to 4 times. So technological innovation, rather than increased investment by the so-called job creators, meant for a much more productive refining industry and a much more productive economy overall. That trend has never wavered. It's the same thing that we've seen over the last, seems to be, 25 years. Now, the question of small business, though, that's a very interesting one to me. As you know, in the book, I make an argument that small business is just not that important because the jobs it creates are transient for the most part. They last about as long as most little startups do, 2 to 3 years. The wages are typically awful, and the benefits are oftentimes absent. Moreover, the small businessmen that I've encountered in the construction trades are not exactly the most scrupulous individuals that I've ever encountered. How's that? So I don't understand why we want to worship at the shrine of small business, except that it's consistent with our political beliefs, our political traditions, where the self-made man has always been the centerpiece of our ideas about economic independence, not being subject to the demagogues and things like that. So there's a good, I think, political argument to be made for the small businessman, the self-made man, but the economic argument to me is completely unconvincing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mike in Rockwall. Hello, Mike.
Hello. I believe Americans are being fed a little bit of a myth in that we always hear the trickle-down economic model will create jobs, basically the premise being help the rich get richer and then they in turn are the, quote, job creators. But I think either trickle-down or trickle-up either will create jobs just as well. The only difference is who gets the initial stimulus and who chases the crumbs. And for a long, long time, it's been the wealthy so-called job creators get the initial bankroll and the rest of the common people sit around waiting for the crumbs. And it gives power. The trickle down or trickle up is going to decide who gets initial power by receiving the money. In other words, if people have a lot of money, then businesses, you'll notice customer service gets much better when they're after our dollars rather than when they get all the money and are sitting on cash and then say, well, you know, we don't really need your business. We've already got $20 billion in the bank. Who, you know, fooey on you.
What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I wish I'd been able to put it as well in the book. I do disagree on one point that Mike makes, and that's it doesn't matter which way it goes, trickle down or trickle up. I think, and I think it can be proven on historical ground, that what he calls a trickle-up model, that is to say, decentering economic decisions by empowering consumers, I think that will create faster growth. I think it will create better jobs. And one of the reasons I think that is that there is a large body of economic literature out there now that shows that investment follows the consumer demand curve, not the other way around. In other words, the trickle-down argument or the classical, neoclassical argument is that investment takes place, jobs are created, those jobs pay workers wages, and they spend the wages, so consumer income and per capita income is rising. I don't think the evidence is there, especially over the last, say, 25 to 30 years. I'm in essential agreement with this caller, Mike. Yeah.
We have an interesting email here from Lee in Richardson who writes, today's politicians all act as though any government spending is just money down a rat hole. When I studied economics some years ago, I was taught that every new dollar introduced into the community from any source was subjected to what was called the multiplier effect. The money gets spent and re-spent, generating about $3 in gain for every new dollar introduced. Has economic theory on this concept changed, or do our politicians simply choose to ignore it?
That's a very good question. I would say that politicians choose to ignore it, but not because they're stupid or because they're politically biased, say. I think it's that, generally speaking, when we talk about the multiplier effect, we're talking about the multiplier effects of investment, that is to say, not consumer spending, but spending which is not on consumer goods, but rather on non-consumable goods like new plant, new equipment, and so forth and so on. So I think it's a very good question. Why can't we treat consumer spending as having a multiplier effect, at least as effective as the so-called multiplier effect for investment? It sounds like a rhetorical question, but it seems to me it should be tested, and we should make the politicians pay attention.
So ideally, if we want to increase consumer spending, we would ensure that consumers have more money in their pockets to spend. If they, however, are working for companies of any size, what do we do to encourage those companies to pay higher wages when they still, I mean, the reality is they still have shareholders to answer to?
Right. Well, I think one way to do it would be to take seriously the prospect or the responsibility of socializing investment. I mean, Americans have always done this. When people say an American standard of living, they're basically saying, what kind of jobs do we want? And behind that question is, what kind of individuals do we want to be? What kind of individuals can we create through a certain kind of economic growth? That's always been the question we've asked since the 1790s. Our answers have always been a mixture of public and private enterprise. We've almost never in our history chosen one over the other. And I think one way to describe the crisis we're living through now is the idea that this, you know, that any government spending goes down a rat hole, that government spending is somehow a constraint on growth because it crowds out private investment. If it crowds out private investment, that'd be fine with me. But in fact, historically speaking now, in fact, it doesn't crowd out private investment. Private investment has been declining. Net private investment has been declining for a long time, with or without government deficits, by the way, with or without huge quantities of government spending.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is James Livingston, author of Against Thrift, Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. Let's go to the phones now. We have Tex on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Tex. Tex, are you with us? Hi, Tex. Okay, we perhaps he'll call back. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Harold in McKinney. Harold says, wealth is created by someone who wanted to be more wealthy, so went into or expanded business to do it. If we make them more wealthy by cutting their taxes, there is no need to invest to do it because they already have their increased wealth with no effort or risk. They want more wealth without doing anything, and that is why the past three tax cuts have not created jobs. What's your perspective on that? Okay, I think we have James is on a cell phone. Okay, we got him back. Jim, are you with us? Okay, we will raise him back on the line. We are speaking this hour with James Livingston. He's professor of history at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. His new book is called Against Thrift: Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. Jim, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Terrific. Okay, great. I don't know if you were able to hear me reading the call from Harold in McKinney. Harold essentially was saying wealth is created by people who want more wealth, and so they go into business to do it, and that the taxes are not necessarily a factor in job creation, which is why recent tax cuts have not created jobs. Similar to what you've been arguing, what do you take on what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think that the outlandishness of CEO pay, it's now roughly 342 times the average worker's pay, as opposed to about 25 years ago. I think the outlandishness of this should tell us something, and that is that people work hard for money up to a point. And then it's not money anymore that they're working for. It's something else. Sometimes it's power. Sometimes it's satisfaction. And that goes for at any level, it seems to me, of the society, whether CEO or worker in an auto plant. Yeah, I think that's worth investigating. That is to say, if we can turn Harold's statement into a question, we can then empirically test the proposition. Do wealthy people actually, what do they do with their money? Are they spending it on high-end consumption, or are they handing it over to their investment brokers and bankers? And then the question becomes, what are the bankers doing with our money or their money? And the answer there pretty clearly is not the things we probably want them to be doing. They're not creating jobs. They're not creating an economy that is anywhere near healthy, robust, balanced, or equitable. In fact, the people in charge of this economy, the very few people who've been controlling investments over the last 25 to 30 years, have botched the job, it seems to me, have done so badly that to keep rewarding them it tells us that we're the stupid one, not them.
Does it matter from an economic perspective what we buy with the money we might as consumers otherwise have saved?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is to suggest that consumer boycotts or consumer movements have been at the forefront of progressive politics for quite some time. Just think of the food revolution of the post-war years, the post-World War II years, led by people like Alice Waters and James Beard. What the food revolution taught us to do was to boycott an industrialized food chain, to treat not just the end products, but the process itself as something worth our scrutiny as consumers. Michael Kinsley has written brilliantly about this, it seems to me, and what he's suggesting in his study of this food revolution is that consumers of food are trying to change the relationship between producers of food and the final consumers, like him, by teaching us to be more discriminating in what we buy, how we buy it, where we buy it, and then what we do with it. That is to say, not just how we consume it, but also how we prepare it. I think mindful consumption is something that that consumer-led movements has taught us. So, in that sense, of course, the book is a celebration of consumer culture. We might want to talk about that, too, by the way, just how does one define consumer culture?
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because we have, I will confess, many times on this program talked about the importance of sort of resisting consumer culture and,
right.
and resisting the sales pitch, as it were.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that the book doesn't quite make as clear as I would have hoped, and I can only say this in retrospect, of course, is it what I mean by consumer culture? By consumer culture, I don't mean mindless consumption. I don't mean the accumulation of silly or trivial things. By consumer culture, I mean, in effect, what we do at our leisure, what we do when we're not at work. And it seems to me, for many, many years, for hundreds of years, in fact, we have taken production or working as the centerpiece of our moral thinking. It goes back to the Protestant work ethic, that having a calling can make you better, shall we say, in the eyes of God, because it will keep you from being merely idle and merely frivolous. What I've tried to suggest here is that the moral possibilities and the moral complexity of buying things and using things is just as great as the moral possibilities and moral complexity of making things, producing things. And I think the evidence is pretty clear, because when we're at work, we have to, for the purposes of our careers or our career advancement, we have to treat our fellow employees as means to that end. So that they, you can't treat them as ends in themselves, even though you will make friends at work. We all do. Those friendships will be cemented not necessarily or not even by what you do at work. They will be cemented by what you do after hours. And when you think about it, what we do at our leisure, that's where we can, in fact, treat people as ends in themselves, rather than means to the end of making more money, making more profit, or just making a living on the job. And so that's what I try to get at. I try to get at the extraordinary complexity of buying the simplest things. I say nobody shops alone.
Let me jump in here. We'll talk more about this in a moment. We'll take a quick break first. My guest is James Livingston. We're talking about his book, Against Thrift. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James Livingston. He's professor of history at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and author of the new book, Against Thrift, Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. I think we're getting toward the soul element of this conversation, Jim. And you were saying before the break that nobody shops alone. There is a social component to consumer culture. You're not only talking here about making socially responsible choices about the products we buy, but about the reality that sometimes we're buying a gift or preparing food that we will share with friends and neighbors. Sometimes our purchases allow us to spend time, quality time, with the people we care about.
Yes. I think one of the ways to think about consumer culture, at least the way I like to think about it, is that it is at least in part, a gift economy, where the point is not to create a monetary gain or surplus, but to produce an emotional climate, if you will, to create a surplus of sociality, social feeling. Yeah, I mean, when we're with our family or with our friends after hours at our leisure, we're spending money to cement social bonds or to create them, to maintain them. So in that sense, I think consumer spending, and not just as strictly speaking gift economy, is better for our souls than what we do for a living. Or let me put it this way: it's at least as good for us as what we do when we're on the job. And it seems to me there's a great deal more of ourselves to discover after hours, at our leisure, in this domain that I call consumer culture. There's a wonderful book out by a guy named Matthew Crawford called Shop Class and Soulcraft. And in it, he argues that one of the ways to redeem ourselves, one of the ways to improve our souls is to make things, right? To use our hands in manual labor. And what is stunning about the book is not just the beauty with which he's able to convey the beautiful words and the beautiful sentences he's able to craft in showing us how that is true. What he demonstrates conclusively is that it's at our leisure that we customize bands or knit sweaters or collect plates. Or, in other words, if we're making things and we're doing it with the kind of care and craft and love that he describes, we're doing it as what we used to call a hobby. We're doing it for the fun of it, not to make money out of it. And that, too, it seems to me, that kind of making is better for our souls than the kind of making we're doing because the boss tells us to.
So ideally, we are working to provide ourselves those experiences and opportunities outside of work.
That's right. In fact, you know,
ideally, we like work, too, but...
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and that used to be a scandal. You know, how can you value leisure over work? Well, one of the ways that I'm arguing in the book is that we're doing things that are better for ourselves, but also for others when we're functioning as consumers, or in a larger sense, when we're inhabiting this domain of life that I call consumer culture. Yeah. I think it's better for us than working for a living. Although, you know, some of us are lucky enough to have jobs we love. I'm lucky enough to have a job I love to do. And it sounds to me like you have that kind of job.
Very, very lucky, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I was thinking, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, most of us, you know, aren't that lucky when it comes to what we do for a living, so.
Yeah, and in some ways, I think having something outside of work that is to look forward to keeps a lot of people, allows them to get through the day doing something that they may not love.
Yes, I think that's right. Now, a lot of critics of consumer culture have turned that around. What they've said is that with a market teeming with goods that you can buy, you are driven into the rat race of working harder so you can buy more things. And it sounds to me like a truism, and I'm not sure that there's much empirical validity to it. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that for most of us, what keeps us going is what we're able to do after hours.
It does seem to me, too, that our judgments about the evils of profligate spending are pretty much always reserved for that of other people. You know, we might say, well, I need, you know, this new computer or this new phone, but gosh, you should have seen my sister-in-law, you know.
Yes, right. Well, that's, I mean, the amazing thing to me is that, look, I mean, the real basic necessities are food and clothing, right? And we can buy all kinds of things to cover our feet and all kinds of things to cover our bodies. But we don't buy food, by and large, just because of its nutritional value, right? There's always some surplus of meaning for us in the food that we prepare and the food that we eat. Hmm. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. The same thing goes for shoes. You know, there's all kinds of ways of covering your feet, but we always, every one of us, no matter how, you know, little vanity we have, when we cover our feet with shoes, we're trying to make a statement about who we are. There's just not much way around that. Even you know, the innumerable specimens of sports sneakers, we choose them very carefully, and we do it for a reason, because there, again, there's this surplus of meaning. It's not profligate spending. It's spending to express oneself. And I don't, and again, I don't see anything wrong with that.
So let's talk about the environmental component here, because your consumer, your sort of discretionary spending may include making what you consider to be wise choices for the environment. But, you know, that darn chemistry professor across campus might not care one bit. You understand what I'm saying? So in encouraging people to consider maybe spending more, saving less, you can't guarantee that this is better for the environment, right?
I don't think, and I hope I didn't leave that impression in the book.
I'm just for argument's sake, because it's in the title.
Yeah, I don't think there's a necessary connection between, let's say, the magnification of consumer culture, both in terms of money incomes, discretionary income, and in terms of our ability to accept it and embrace it. I don't think there's a necessary connection. But on the other hand, I do think that, again, historically speaking, the consumers have led the way on the environment. The food revolution is a consumer boycott of an industrialized and very, very chemically laden food chain. But you can go beyond that, I think. And here's where you have to start talking about, this is where you start mixing up the morality of spending and the question of economic growth. The model of economic growth we have now is driven by this endless pursuit of more money in the bank, right?
Mm-hmm.
Profits, wealth, but wealth in the abstract, what the ancients called exchange value. Marx did too, of course, but he got it from Aristotle and others. That model, it seems to me, has driven growth in quite demented ways, especially, it seems to me, over the last 25 to 30 years. So if we can rethink a model of growth by decentering decisions and giving consumers more power, it seems to me we have a better chance of environmental integrity. Why? Because consumers are not interested in growth as such, right? They know the things they buy are going to depreciate, decay, and probably eventually die. But their use values, they want something with a particular social, emotional meaning. That's what they want to buy, and that's what they want to use. They're not interested in growth for its own sake. They actually care less about growth than the people who drive this model so far. So in that sense, I think if we can rethink and re-ask the question of what kind of growth do we actually want, if we can empower consumers, if we can involve the 99% in addressing that question, then I think our chances of environmental integrity in both the short and the long term get better. Now, it's not, I can't tell you, I can't tell you that's a done deal or that there's a lock on that. But our chances are better, it seems to me, if we can decenter decisions about our economic futures. The way I put it in the book is we've reached a stage that is at least comparable, at least analogous to what Eastern Europe faced in the 1960s and 70s, and that was whether to have an extensive model of growth based on saving and investment, according to the plan, or intensive growth, a model of growth driven by consumer expenditures. We reached that point, and it seems to me the decision should be clear by now. We need to decenter these decisions, just like they have tried to do in Eastern Europe. We can do it better because we have a political system that's more robust, at least more committed to democratic procedures than anything in Eastern Europe. But that's the point we've reached.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Eric on the line in Plano. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Yes. I have a comment on something we talked about earlier, but first on this topic, I would just say, whether each family, whether they spend or save, I would just encourage people to budget, because then you know what you have. And, I personally, I use up every bit of my vacation, and I work to live. Every person's situation is different. People have to find out what it is they want to do with their money. And I think a lot of people go on emotions. Now they may be saving a lot because of the macro economy, but if they would budget, they would know what they have and figure out what they want to do with it.
And to clarify, Jim, you are not suggesting that people go into debt that they cannot repay.
No. In fact, I would say that people went into debt in such huge numbers because wages stagnated. One way to solve the consumer debt problem is, I guess, we should immediately forgive student loan debt. That's one way to do it. But the other way to reduce the risk of consumer debt is to get better wages out there. Let's stop with the stagnation of wages and make sure that people have enough income to get by. I mean, that's why people went into debt. They didn't go into debt because, they were profligate spending. I mean, or spending profligate. Never mind, I can't.
Profligately, it's a tough word. It's interesting, though, because there are periodic discussions about, raising the minimum wage and government mandates for wages. Right. Is that the most effective way to put more money in people's pockets, workers' pockets?
No, I don't think it's the most effective way. I think it's one way, and in the short term, it can work. I think a better way would be to stop discouraging working people from organizing and joining unions. I think if that countervailing force or power, as John Kenneth Galbraith called it, was in force today, this ridiculously lopsided economy, where, again, CEOs are making 342 times what the average worker is, that wouldn't have happened, and it seems to me, in the presence of a robust labor movement. So what the NLRB is doing over the last 3 or 4 days, it seems to me that's a step in the right direction, too. But I also think that the demonization of government spending, for example, so-called entitlements or transfer payments, the demonization of that is also a way of putting more money in the hands of more people. The crucial thing there, however, is that we Americans are so accustomed to hating the idea of people getting something for nothing that we don't understand that we can afford now to be our brother's keeper. That using these entitlements to support people in their old age or using these entitlements for other purposes, this is not immoral behavior. In fact, it's consistent with the highest possible moral precepts of every religion we know of. And that is, you are, in fact, your brother's keeper. We know we can afford to be now. Why shouldn't we give it a try? That would be a third way, it seems to me, of putting more money in the hands of more people.
Has this election cycle made you more or less hopeful that we will move in this direction?
I think Obama's chances of winning get better almost every day because the Republican primaries seem to reveal to me, and I think to a lot of people, that party is increasingly out of touch with the needs and the desires of the people as a whole, but particularly the electorate as such.
Got about 15 seconds, by the way.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's quite all right. But I think there is a real choice here, and I think because Obama's chances are good. I'm not that discouraged, to tell you the truth. I'm not so sure he's done all he could to promote growth, balanced growth. But given the political circumstances in Washington, D.C., I think he's done the best he can.
James Livingston is professor of history at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. His new book is called Against Thrift, Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. Jim, fascinating topic. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.